The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 543, recorded on July 9th,
43rd edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and 376th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am TJ Dinser.
I am Scott Dirk.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and a gaming flashback.
I was just thinking, you know, how many podcasts just casually say, oh yeah, this is the 543rd podcast?
Not that many, but I'm sure there's some.
I mean, this podcast was started in 2007, which means it's been going on for 12 years.
It's a lot of podcast.
It's a lot of years. I mean, how old are you, TJ?
31.
So think about it. This started when you were still a teenager.
Yeah, I guess it would have been 19. Yeah. No. Yes. Maybe? I don't know. Math.
Well, I mean, if you haven't had your birthday yet, then you could have been 20.
I would have been 19.
Okay. So yeah, this has been going on a long time. So yeah, we do have a gaming flashback because since I'm part of the Xbox Game Pass, I decided to download a Rare Replay, and I said, oh yeah, I had played that. So I decided to play this game on the gaming flashback. Go ahead, TJ.
Our gaming flashback today is Viva Piñata. Viva Piñata is a 2006 life simulation game developed by Rare and published by Microsoft Game Studios for the Xbox 360. The game revolves around the player tending to a neglected garden in Piñata Island, in which different variations of piñatas must be bred while whilst fending off disruptive interlopers. When certain requirements are fulfilled, the garden will attract a black and white outline of a given piñata species. After fulfilling additional requirements, the piñata will become a resident, changing into a full-color version. Once two piñatas of the same species are residents and their mating requirements are met, they can perform a romance dance. If the player successfully completes a maze minigame, the romance results in a baby piñata egg, which is delivered by a stork. The piñatas are not gendered, and hence any two piñatas of the same species can mate. Once a piñata species has successfully been romanced, the player can use a candy shortcut to bypass their original romance requirements. The player can hatch the egg or send it to another player over Xbox Live. The game's antagonists include ruffians led by Professor Pester and sour piñatas who occasionally enter the player's garden with the sole intent of wreaking havoc. Eating seeds, dropping poisonous piñata candies, and destroying objects. The player may tame sour piñatas by constructing fences around them. Weeds may occasionally sprout in the player's garden and will quickly spread to destroy vegetable rows if the player does not kill them in time. After the release of Viva Piñata in 2006, its development team saw it as incomplete. The developers cut partial ideas from the release to meet their deadlines. Rare's Greg Mails said that the game sold well and was steadily on par with their expectations, and Xbox executive Phil Spencer added that the game was considered a success inside the company. The team incorporated player feedback and worked towards a more definitive version of the original. A sequel, Viva Piñata, Trouble in Paradise, was announced in May 2008 and released in September of that year. The sequel adds more than 30 new piñata species, a just-for-fun sandbox mode, and new cooperative modes, as well as a new desert and Arctic environment. Rare announced plans to release a Nintendo DS version of the game at Comic-Con 2007. It was later revealed to be titled Viva Piñata Pocket Paradise, and was subsequently released in 2008. Key changes included a control scheme which makes use of the stylus, as well as the presence of additional context-sensitive information on the second screen. On October 30th, 2007, a party game spinoff, Viva Piñata Party Animals, was released for the Xbox 360. Developed by Chrome Studios, the game features the TV show Piñata characters competing in races in close to 50 party minigames.
You know, I remember when it first came out that people were complaining that it was really, really hard, and that you know, it was really aimed at kids, right? But I'll say a lot of adults loved it. So when I reinstalled it now in 2019, I got so many pinatas entering my garden. It was like a rush. And I remember when I first played Viva Pinata, I was lucky to have four species enter. So, yeah, they definitely patched up the game to make it a lot easier, which I don't know how to feel about that. I mean, the sense of accomplishment of, say, having a bunny come into your garden or a doe. I never had a deer enter my garden. This time the deer actually entered my garden. So, I don't know. I think I preferred it being harder. I think I would have felt more accomplishment had it been harder to get those species in the garden. Or maybe I'm just better. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure I didn't. I had five different species wandering in at the hour gameplay mark. I was just, no, this is my garden is getting too populated already. I don't know. Did either of you ever play Viva Pinata?
No, heard of it.
I was fully aware of this game, but it was never something that I had, I guess, availability or interest in at the various given times that it was released. I didn't have access to the first one, and I feel like I would have been more on board with this had I been in the entry point. But like by the time that I took notice of it when it was coming out on like Xbox 360 and the Nintendo DS, I think it was a little past my time for interest.
I'm going to tell you something that a lot of adults love this game. I mean, it was supposed to be intended for children. If you ever watched the TV show, you know, actually, you know, the TV show is sort of like a precursor to My Little Pony. Friendship is Magic. If you watch the old TV, the cartoon for Viva Pinata, you'll say, hey, this looks a lot like My Little Pony. It was that, you know, and I'm talking about the Lauren Faust My Little Pony. I mean, you know, intelligent, you know, but for kids. But a lot of adults were really into this game, which surprised a lot of people. Then again, you know, maybe people on the Xbox 360 wanted their own version of Pokemon, and this was it.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to have a lot of parallels with something like Pokemon, but also like Animal Crossing and The Sims in various different ways.
And Animal Crossing. Although, you know, one of the things is that, you know, you could beat a pinata and beat it until it popped open, like the pinata it is, and all the candy spread out and all the other. It's funny when you have the pigeon attacking the worm, and the worm dies, and all of its candy pops out. The bird comes over and starts eating that candy. Yum 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 yum. it's very candy sweet National Geographic brutality. Because you had to be careful because you could have your animals turning on each other, and suddenly your garden is a wasteland of little candy wrappers and candies all over the place. I think it was that darkness that attracted adults too. Sort of like, yeah, this is for kids, but you know, there's a lot of mean shit going on around here. Be careful or else your animals will feast on the innards of another animal. even if it is candy.
A little bit terrifying nonetheless.
Yeah, so I never played Pocket Paradise. I never played Trouble in Paradise. I plan to, since I don't have achievements for that game. So it'll be interesting for me to see how the game changed. Although, like I said, they patched up the game to be a lot easier. And like I said, I don't know if I like that. I like to earn my pinatas.
For a lot of people, it's as simple as like having the option to, like, if you don't want to go the easy route, have that difficulty level in there. And it would be weird. Like, if what you're saying is true, it kind of sounds like they just patched it out entirely, and that's kind of unfortunate because some people do like having it harder.
I mean, like, I want to work for my pinatas to earn it. I never got very far in the original game because at some point, all my pinatas would start turning on each other. In a vicious candy apocalypse. But now all I need to do is cover my entire garden in grass, and oh, here comes a deer. And I never saw a deer coming in ever in my original play of the game. Like I said, maybe I just sucked back then. I don't know. There is a lot of micromanagement that goes on in the game, so I mean, maybe they took that out. Maybe that was the problem for a lot of kids. It wasn't the difficulty. It was more the micromanagement. So they made it a lot easier to deal with. But still, I don't know.
I mean, I guess there's no reason if I was to jump into something like this now, I guess there's something that would be a little bit therapeutic about that. Because I do love Graveyard. I do love Graveyard Keeper. And it doesn't sound...
This, though. If you play it now, the game is absolutely gorgeous. And it was gorgeous then, and it's even more gorgeous now. I don't know if they upscaled it to 4K, but man, it looks really good. I mean, it looks like it was released last year.
Yeah, it definitely always had a distinctive style that looked like it would translate well over time with just a little bit of polish here and there.
Yeah, but I'm just saying the textures look like they're upscaled, and everything is sharp and looks beautiful. And I have to believe that they also, you know, added those textures because it looks like it was released last year for the Xbox One. It looks absolutely gorgeous. It is a Microsoft game, so, you know, they probably may have bumped it up. And, you know, but like I said, if you want to try Viva Piñata or, you know, or just get Rare Replay. I mean, it comes with Perfect Dark, Perfect Dark HD. It comes with all the Viva Piñata games. It comes with all the games that were ever released for Rare on console, for the Microsoft console. So, I mean, might as well get that.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm gonna. I don't know if it's something that I would go for anytime soon, but it does seem like something like if I had some spare time and there were no games coming, yeah. I might give it a go.
I played Perfect Dark Zero back in the day, and I thought it was awful. I'm gonna see if my opinion has changed at all, because I really did not like Perfect Dark Zero. I never played Perfect Dark HD though, which is a remaster of the original Perfect Dark, so that'll be interesting. So in a double swipe, we did Gaming Flashback and what I've been playing at the same time. What have you been playing, Scott?
I've been playing – I've finished up Cadence, and I've been trying to finish up Octopath. And
by Cadence, you mean Cadence of Hyrule?
Yes, Cadence of Hyrule. I completed that one. It is, I guess, yeah, a short game if you go straight to the mini-bosses and then go to the boss, so you can – probably like streamline it, but I liked collecting all the little things that the character can use and trying to get as much heart containers as I could before fighting the final boss. And I think they kind of leave it a little bit open ended. I don't know if I should say anything, but it just I feel like it leaves it open ended for maybe other worlds to be mixed with Crypt of the Necrodancer is what I should say. Sorry. So it was interesting. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a challenging game.
You know, I will say this. Cadence of Hyrule have been trending really highly. So much so that Game Watcher, which basically is a PC-only website, actually covered it. That's how much it was trending.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this could be ported to PC if they want to, but you know, I know it's Nintendo's.
No, I just mean that it was. I'm pretty sure it was more popular than the developers actually thought it would be.
Yeah. I agree. I think it does seem to have gone beyond what they expected. But, you know, I'm glad that this was a quality game, and I'm glad the developers had a chance to combine Hyrule with Necrodancer.
Yeah. How about you, TJ? What have you been playing?
So I jumped into a couple games this last week. The first one was a mobile game, which is rare for me. I don't usually do mobile. But it's called Teppan, and it's a collaborative effort between Capcom and another group called Gung Ho. It's basically a card game with Capcom characters. Like, you... it's not too far different from like the deck setup for Hearthstone, where you have hero decks, and then you have a certain type of card that is applied to each hero deck. Like for instance, Ryu is red deck. He has a lot of fighting cards and cards that do direct attack damage to enemy heroes. Whereas like Dante and Morrigan the succubus are a little bit more tricksterish and have like cards that will either stop a card from attacking, send it back to the enemy player's deck, or just like stall the fight a little bit and mess around with things. I've been playing Nier Gigante, which is a monster from Monster Hunter, and his whole thing is just like brute force self-sacrifice. He has a lot of characters. He has a lot of characters in his deck that can be buffed to like absurd attack levels, and then like they can do one attack and then they destroy themselves. Or he sacrifices a little bit of life from his health pool to like empower these characters and make them stronger. So it's really fun. I've enjoyed it quite a lot. The games don't take too long.
I mean, maybe they took that out. Maybe that was a problem for a lot of kids. It wasn't the difficulty. It was more the micromanagement. So they made it a lot easier to deal with. But still, I don't know.
I mean, I guess there's no reason if I was to jump into something like this now, I guess there's something that would be a little bit therapeutic about that. Because I do love Graveyard. I do love Graveyard Keeper. And it doesn't sound...
This, though. If you play it now... The game is absolutely gorgeous, and it was gorgeous then, and it's even more gorgeous now. I don't know if they upscaled it to 4K, but man, it looks really good. I mean, it looks like it was released last year.
Yeah, it definitely always had a distinctive style that looked like it would translate well over time with just a little bit of polish here and there.
Yeah, but I'm just saying the textures look like they're upscaled, and everything is sharp and looks beautiful. And I have to believe that they also, you know, added those textures because it looks like it was released last year for the Xbox One. It looks absolutely gorgeous. It is a Microsoft game, so, you know, they probably may have bumped it up. And, you know, but like I said, if you want to try Viva Piñata or, you know, or just get Rare Replay, I mean, it comes with Perfect Dark, Perfect Dark HD. It comes with all the Viva Piñata games. It comes with all the games that were ever released for Rare. I mean, maybe they took that out. Maybe that was a problem for a lot of kids. It wasn't the difficulty. It was more the micromanagement. So they made it a lot easier to deal with. But still, I don't know.
I mean, I guess there's no reason if I was to jump into something like this now, I guess there's something that would be a little bit therapeutic about that. Because I do love Graveyard. I do love Graveyard Keeper. And it doesn't sound...
This, though. If you play it now... The game is absolutely gorgeous, and it was gorgeous then, and it's even more gorgeous now. I don't know if they upscaled it to 4K, but man, it looks really good. I mean, it looks like it was released last year.
Yeah, it definitely always had a distinctive style that looked like it would translate well over time with just a little bit of polish here and there.
Yeah, but I'm just saying the textures look like they're upscaled, and everything is sharp and looks beautiful. And I have to believe that they also, you know, added those textures because it looks like it was released last year for the Xbox One. It looks absolutely gorgeous. It is a Microsoft game, so, you know, they probably may have bumped it up. And, you know, but like I said, if you want to try Viva Piñata or, you know, or just get Rare Replay, I mean, it comes with Perfect Dark, Perfect Dark HD. It comes with all the Viva Piñata games. It comes with all the games that were ever released for Rare on...
I really do like what it's given me so far. It's kind of smart in the way it makes you look after things, look after, like, suspects, check clues and all that stuff. And I feel like it's a little early yet for me to talk about, like, everything about it, but I really do feel like it's going to be a fun time. It's quite a bit different from the regular affair from the Yakuza studio, which is usually just brute force beating the heck out of everybody.
Serious faced men disco stomping other serious faced men.
So I'm gonna have fun with that. I'm gonna report back on that. I'm hoping I've wanted a game that's sort of like LA Noire, but like proficient for a long time. I was kind of hoping Vampyr would be a little bit like that, which it was in certain ways, but then not in others. I was hoping Call of Cthulhu would be kind of like that, but you had a quite a few problems with Call of Cthulhu, so I kind of backed off that one.
Well, and try the Council, which is just batshit crazy, if you can get past the bad voice acting of the main character.
I was also looking at The Sinking City, which is another Call of Cthulhu-inspired game. But I've heard
the thing. The people who are developing The Sinking City were actually the original developers of Call of Cthulhu.
Right. And I've heard good things about it, but I've also heard that there are quite a few tedious things in there, which...
It got a 7 on Game Watcher, so I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard that there's some backtracking and very difficult sort of piecing together of information that you have. So I was a little bit hesitant to jump in all the way on that one yet. I might give it a go later, but for right now I'm going to go with Judgment because it kind of has all the things I want.
Okay. So we're going to move on to game news. No Man's Sky's Sean Murray says developers should be quiet after a rough launch. Gee, I wonder why he would say that. This is from PC Gamer. During his keynote at Dev Conference, Develop Brighton, Hello Games' Sean Murray offers some advice for developers facing the type of troubled launch that No Man's Sky experienced when expectations and reality collided. It's simple advice, but undoubtedly harder than it sounds. Stop talking. According to Sean Murray, we went into 2 years of without talking to the press at all, and we went about 3 months without saying anything to the community either. That was really hard. I sat down so many times and wrote the perfect blog post that was going to explain everything about the game's development and the roadmap going ahead, but I could see that it didn't hold credibility with regards to where we were at. Over the last year, there have been several high-profile launches that went poorly, and in those cases, the studios have been a lot more communicative. With Fallout 76, Anthem, and Sea of Thieves, the respective teams were on Twitter and giving interviews acknowledging the issues and problems and changes, followed by roadmaps and piecemeal updates. Quietly working away ended up being the right way for Hello Games to do things, but it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all solution. Anthem's taken a beating this year, but whenever BioWare shares its plans or discusses its issues, there's a wave of goodwill from players who want to know where the game is going. In the case of Sea of Thieves, Rare has managed to turn the game around and keep players informed. They didn't do more of the banana and what was that bit with the banana and the pineapple, was it?
The one where you can just straight up eat a pineapple without peeling it at all.
Yeah, but you were talking about that comedic bit.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Oh, wait, pin, pineapple, apple pin?
Yeah, something like that. Even last year, it was starting to show its potential. A year later, and it's still popular, and the community is largely happy and heading to in a similar direction as No Man's Sky. Even Fallout 76, the butt of jokes for a while, is starting to look promising, and having a roadmap that lets players know that NPCs are coming and when they will be able to start setting up their own stores kept people interested, even after the initial disappointment. And, oh, by the way, we can also point out TJ's favorite game, Rainbow Six Siege, which had a really rocky launch. But Ubisoft just kept at it and at it and at it and, you know, talked to the community a lot. And now Rainbow Six Siege is one of the most popular esports games.
Right. And I think there's a point to, like, both sides of this. Like, Sean Murray definitely has a point that if you start making promises and then you don't keep that promise, you just continue to build bad will and hate. And in this community, people remember bad things for a long time and just continue to build on that harassment. So... if you don't have what it takes to back that up, it's a good idea to be quiet for a while. But, I mean, in the case of Fallout 76, I think they could have stood to be quiet for a while and then just, like, come back when they were ready to show something that was really, really good, like where we are – kind of where we are now with them. In the case of Anthem, I feel like they have the surplus to just sort of make the changes that they want to make over time. So, like, I guess for them, it makes more sense to be chatty.
I like when a developer is transparent about what's going on. I can understand keeping focus on what they're working on and not getting distracted by, you know, online presence. I don't really remember anyone from the Fallout 76 team talking at all, so I'm kind of surprised there was any communication. I thought they were just doing their thing. And I don't remember CFDs having any issues.
Bethesda was talking to fans through the message boards and Twitter, so it's not like they were posting news items. You know, I mean, there was a news item about the upcoming NPCs and stuff, but basically, a lot of these, like Rainbow Six Siege, Ubisoft just basically conferred with players. You know, I mean, players on the official forums. And
I guess what I think is a good then medium is what Obsidian would do with their games when they were developing them. They would release an update, but still keep generally focused on doing the work and not getting distracted on forums and Twitter. There'd be PR reps for that. to do that, that would be hired specifically for communicating.
Yeah, we're talking about post-launch disasters. Basically.
Right, right. I figure there should be the developer themselves should be focused on the game, and if they need to have someone doing PR, then that would be their job specifically, and not be distracted. So I can see what he's getting at then. Yeah.
Keisha?
Yeah, like I said, I think that it was the right call for them to make, like, especially as an indie studio. You don't have a lot. You don't have just like unlimited resources to work with. In fact, you have a very limited amount of resources to work with. So for an indie studio that is really kind of trying to make something from a bad situation, I think Sean Murray and the team did the right thing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of that was manufactured by Sony, though, because Sony showed off their game in like three straight E3s and made it out to be something bigger than it really wasn't. I mean, No Man's Sky was never going to be a $60 game. I mean, it wasn't made to be a $60 game. It was sold for $60, but it was one of those. I mean, No Man's Sky was nothing new. We've seen exploration games like it. Elite Dangerous comes right to mind. You know, No Man's Sky just felt like it should have been a $30 game. You know, a AA game, but they felt the pressure. You know, all those Sony fanboys were talking about how No Man's Sky was incredible. It's something they'd never seen before, something they'd never seen before, because we'd certainly seen it before. And, like, it was going to be the best game ever. Hello Games sort of felt the pressure of, like, holy shit. You know, we're best known for Joe Danger here. Joe Danger is our biggest game.
It's never good to state that this is the best game ever that always seems to
lead. Yeah, but they never said it. It was the fans who made it, and Sony made it out to be that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're featured in a major publisher's, you know, when they give your game an entire segment, you know, I mean, that's sort of the problem that the people who did We Happy Few had to deal with. Microsoft showed off We Happy Few, showed off the trailer, and I'll say that trailer is really good. You know, I think they should have spent another year on it, and it would have been just fine.
Yeah, I think the Fallout 76 was a bigger disaster launch disaster than No Man's Sky, because like you said, Fallout 76 had this huge resources to back that game up, whereas No Man's Sky was a much, much smaller studio. So it does make sense for maybe No Man's Sky devs to focus on their game and not, you know, interact with the community that much, or at least, you know, give maybe official statements, but not like spend every day on Twitter or forums as opposed to Fallout 76.
I think Microsoft's really smart in dealing with Cuphead, because Microsoft showed off the Cuphead, you know, it was like a teaser trailer like a few years ago, and people went nuts over it. So Microsoft took the development team aside and said, make the game bigger. make more of that. We're going to give you a year and a half to make more of it. We want more of that so that when we finally release it, it's not just some little indie game. We want it to be a full-fledged AA game, you know? So that's what happened with Cuphead. And, you know, I think you have to have the balls that when you see people reacting really positively, you can say, you know what? We're going to hold off on this and make it better. Which is basically why Peter Molyneux sold Double Fine to Microsoft, because he said that the game that they were going to release, Psychonauts 2, the Psychonauts 2 they were going to release was going to be a different game than the Psychonauts 2 they're going to release now that they have Microsoft's money behind them.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. I mean, like, suddenly you open up the gates to lot more possibilities, like one person testing things and then becomes maybe like two or three or four or five people testing things and ironing out all the bugs, seeing what works, what doesn't work, and just like you have more overhead to allow for the just like exploration of opportunities that you didn't have before.
Scott?
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think that's what's coming down to is if you're a bigger company, you have obviously more resources and you can have someone communicate with the community, which I think is probably a good idea. but like a small indie company that does make sense. So, yeah.
We're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, DJ.
Xbox Game Pass adds Play Later feature from Eurogamer. There's a new feature for Xbox Game Pass, Microsoft's game subscription service, with now over 200 games included. It's called Play Later, and it lives on your console desktop under the Xbox Game Pass section. You can also curate it via the Xbox mobile app. As you'd expect, it's a list of things you want to play when you're able to find the time. Something that many people find themselves thinking about a lot when browsing the bulging Games Pass vault. It's a wish list, then, except that you already own access to everything on it. The only thing you're missing is the time to get stuck in. Xbox One's July update, which should begin rolling out about now, includes this and also improvements to the Xbox skill for Alexa. You can now browse the Game Pass catalog using your voice, and ask which games are new and which may be leaving soon. And finally, Alexa support is being added to Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Mexico, and Spain.
That's an interesting concept. I mean, here's the thing, you know, I mean, whenever I have my Humble Bundle games, you know, it's sort of like I have a lot of games that I have not played 1 minute on. And it's sort of, this game was purchased on July 3rd, 2013. No time played on it. It's sort of like looking accusingly at you. Why haven't you played me yet?
Yeah, that's a little embarrassing, isn't it, to have a game that you've bought and haven't played.
So yeah, I find it interesting that the game will pop up and say, hey, remember me? You wanted to play me at some point. Let me know when you have free time to play me.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that, like, I wonder, so it's only games that have come into the Game Pass, right? You can't, like, make a wish list thing on something that you want to see.
Here's the thing. I wonder if that's going to be something it'll do, is, like, here's the thing. I don't know if they've ever hinted, like, 3 months from now, this is going to be on Xbox Game Pass. You know, do you want to wish list it? I guess it could be possible.
That would be cool. I mean, like, who knows if it is possible or not, but, like, even then, the idea of something that would sort of, like, ping you when it's about, especially when something is about to leave the Xbox Game Pass if that happens,
yeah.
Like, then it, I mean, I would like to know something like that, so maybe I know and I can take the opportunity to play it while it's free before it goes away.
Yeah, I mean, but the wish list, you know, like I said, I'd like to see how it's implemented. Like, does it remind you, oh, by the way, you have this game that you've been meaning to play if you want to have the free time to play it now? You know? Because, like, you know, there are games that, you know, that I always find myself wanting to play and I just forget about.
Yeah. And, like, I don't know if I would want something that reminds me too frequently, but, like, especially when it's about, if it's about to leave the system.
Or maybe, like, when you install one game, you know, when you're uninstalling one game from the hard drive, it'll say, oh, you're uninstalling that game? Well, guess what? Do you want to play this game, which you've had on your list for a while? I think that's probably how it'll work.
How crazy would it be if it recognized when you finished a game and it was just, like, straight up, like, it saw the achievement.
Finish that game. You want to try a new one?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, here's the thing, you know, Steam works by recognizing the pattern of the games that I play, and sometimes, you know, it has the, hey, you like that game, want to play this game? So I wonder if the wish of the play later will also work like that, too.
That's a good question. Who knows? Like, I guess we'll be relying on you to tell us how it works, because it's supposed to be coming pretty shortly.
I wonder if it'll work for the PC side, too.
That's what I like about the Steam wish list. They put a bunch of games on a wish list that I might want to play, and then I just go back and see if there's something I actually want to buy or not.
Anyway, we're just going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay. Nintendo Switch 2 controller could redefine how people play games, company suggests. This is from the Independent UK. Nintendo is working on a new controller that could change how people play games, it has said, recognizing that the traditional way of playing on consoles is still popular, but could be overhauled. The company is trying out new ideas that could see it once again release a new way of interfacing with games. Nintendo helped introduce the controller system that is used on consoles to this day and has been for nearly 30 years. but it has also repeatedly tried and sometimes failed to make that old-fashioned with systems like the Wii U's motion controllers. Now it says that the future technology, such as the Nintendo Switch 2, could come with yet more ways of redefining the controller. At a recent shareholder meeting, Nintendo bosses were asked about the fact that the games are still almost universally played in the same way by someone looking at a screen with a controller in their hand, as they have been for 30 years. Executives were asked how developers felt about that and whether it would change in the future. Nintendo director Shinya Takahashi noted that the company was already working to change this paradigm. He pointed to games like 1-2 Switch and the Nintendo Labo cardboard kits, which changed both the controller and the way people actually play the game with it. He noted that all the games shown off at this year's E3 conference did stick with the traditional way of playing, but then he went on to suggest that could be about to change. Our objective is to achieve an interface that surpasses the current controller, with what player does is directly reflected on the screen, and the user can clearly feel the result. This has not been achieved yet. We have tried all kinds of motion controllers, but none seem to work for all people. As the company that knows the most about controllers, we have been striving to create a controller that can be used with ease and that will become the standard for the next generation.
Yeah, the company that knows all about controllers, yeah. Let's look at your tiny little break-apart controllers for the Switch as we have, which everybody loves, right?
Yeah, those Joy-Cons could be a lot bigger.
Yeah, well, that's why they have the Pro controller for $80 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. Until you have holograms, you know, or tactile virtual reality, it's not going to change. I mean, look at planes. Planes have been using joysticks since the Wright brothers. They haven't changed it. If there was a motion control on an airplane, it would be a disaster.
I don't know why they feel that this needs to be changed. Using a controller is very comfortable, and there's almost a very comforting feeling using it. I have not really seen issue. Like, people like their Xbox controllers and they like their PlayStation controllers, and generally it works.
Because
so I don't know why it needs to be.
Gimmicks sell.
I will say this: Nintendo has always been the company that creates a problem and then tries to solve it.
Let's play Wii Music, everybody.
If they want to know how to make a good controller, though, like, I will say this, look to Microsoft. You got that working relationship with Microsoft, and they are doing some of the best work when it comes to that, between like the Elite controller and the Adaptive controller, especially.
What did you think of the Elite controller too?
I think that it's impressive, just like how much you can do with it. It's got a lot of options as far as, like, I don't know that it would be great for me for fighting games because I've never liked that D-pad the way that it's set up.
They have two D-pads for it, though. They have the traditional D-pad, and they have the but they did actually for the Elite controller too. They did add the clickiness for fighting games, you know, so that, you know, you could change the clickiness of the controllers, which is
incredible. Right. The amount of swap in, swap out that you can do with that controller is very impressive. And then the adaptive controller
costs $180.
Yeah, but then there's the adaptive controller, and the adaptive controller is just like, that is a controller that's literally designed to work for anyone, regardless of their circumstances in life. And I think that's impressive how hard Microsoft has worked on that, both with like just like their regular players and with like the disabled community.
You know what I miss? You remember the quiz show game that came with the buzzers? That is next gen to me. You know, instead of having a controller, you just have that button. So when you know the answer, you hit the button and say, okay.
Right, but you probably can't throw that in a box and slap an $80 price tag on it, which is probably one of Nintendo's problems with that.
Because here's the problem with Nintendo and other companies that have shareholders. They got to have the constant profit year after year after year. You know, you just can't make money. You have to make more money than you were making before so that the stocks can go up, which is damaging, you know.
Right.
Just leave it alone, you know.
Just make good games. I mean, it's like that's the thing that people have been asking for Nintendo to do, is to do new IPs. That's what they should develop if they want more money.
New IPs.
Yeah.
I mean, Luigi's Mansion 3 is all right, and so is Mario Maker 2, and so is another Zelda game, but, you know, where's the next...
I said new.
Where's the next, IP. I know, where's the next Pikmin? Or, not an actual Pikmin, I just mean new IP. Like
Kid Icarus games, or some, maybe go back to Crystalis, or, you know, Battle of Olympus. There's so many games they could revisit. And
or not even develop. Revisit, just invent. I mean, Splatoon was exciting for a lot of people, because that was a new IP.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. They love that. I don't know if I want to use the word battle royale.
It's an online multiplayer game in which you're trying to paint more space than the other people on the board.
Right.
You take people out, but
it's still an arena game.
You can quote unquote kill other players, but that's not the point of the game. The point of the game is to occupy the most, to paint the most of the level.
Mm-hmm.
So sort of like Crystal Castles or something.
Yeah, we don't need new controllers. We need new games. I mean, that just seems really obvious, and I don't see why this is a difficult question here.
Yeah. And here's the thing, Nintendo should do more online, and they're in a unique position because they're not dominated by online like Microsoft and Sony. You know, they're not controlled by having to have all these multiplayer games, another Call of Duty and all that stuff. I mean, you can have more online games, Nintendo. I mean, I know a lot of people who really want to do something that's Animal Crossing multiplayer online, you know, or... Here's the thing, there used to be The Sims Online. I thought that could have been such a killer game if they did it right, and they didn't do it right. They could have done it so much better. So, I don't know. But yeah, a new controller isn't the answer, unless you want to make it a toy again and suck up to the casual fans again, like you did in 2006 and 2007, which backfired when you wanted to sell the Wii U, and the people who bought the Wii casually said, "Nah, we have the Wii."
I mean, at the end of the day, Nintendo is kind of a double-edged sword with this stuff. Sometimes it absolutely backfires on them. It's a problem that doesn't need to be solved, and they're just overthinking it. But
yes. Well,
there are other times where it's like they come up with things, and it ends up being the Switch, or it ends up being the Wii Fit, or it's things like that, just like ridiculous things that people end up loving.
Nintendo always wants to team up with people and it never ends up happening. Like,
yeah, that Wii Fit board, that thing annoyed me so much.
Remember, I'm talking about
it was like the hottest thing for the time that it existed. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. I remember working
until
at Target at the time.
Little girls fat.
Sorry?
And then it started calling little girls fat.
You're cutting off, Jonah.
And then, I can hear myself.
You roboted and cut off. We can't hear you.
I hope we didn't lose them.
I hope not.
And then the Wii Fit board started calling everybody fat.
Yeah, that was what I didn't like.
They called
right,
girls
but like
fat.
Even if it was like ridiculous, it was also just like stupid popular. Like I worked at Target at the time that thing was coming out, and we couldn't keep that thing in stock for any reason. People would like come into our store, like. The same way that people like come in to shop cards and go ahead.
No, I thought it stopped recording. Keep going.
I was gonna say the same way that people like hunt for like rare Hot Wheels, or the way that people hunt for like rare baseball cards. These people would come in and just shop for Wii Fit boards and ask us all the time if we got Wii Fit boards and wonder when the next shipment of Wii Fit boards was coming. It was ridiculous, but like.
You know,
people,
when I went to a convention like this year, last year, they had a whole bunch of stands with different video games, and I never saw any Wii products there. There was all like old Nintendo, NES, N64, PlayStation games, and Xbox games, but I never saw any Wii stuff sitting there.
Really? Not even Princess? Not even Twilight Princess or hardware?
Video games. Physical video games.
That's odd. Because there were some really good Wii games.
There were.
I mean, there was Zombie U, which was for the Wii U, actually. But there were too many carnival games for the Wii.
Yeah. It was definitely a shovelware system.
But anyway, getting back to, you know, I think here's the funny thing is that Nintendo has always been cozy with other developers. I mean, the only reason why the NES exists is that Atari decided not to team up with Nintendo, and then Sega didn't team up with Nintendo, and then Sony didn't team up with Nintendo. So right now, it looks like they might team up with Microsoft, but not for a new console, just to get the Xbox Live ecology on the Switch, which I think would really expand because, you know, Microsoft will tell Nintendo, guess what? Don't worry about online. We'll worry about online for you. You know, we know about parental control, so you don't have to worry about that either. I mean, that's the only thing that Nintendo really lacks, is the ability to do really, really good online. I mean, they proved they could do it with Splatoon, if they really, really wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's just not a company that likes to do things traditional, I guess, sort of. They always feel like they gotta reinvent the wheel, and
they do things too traditionally, and that's what's bitten them in the ass. Because a lot of big developers left Nintendo because they were chafing that all these old guys saying, no, you can't do that. That's not how we do things here.
Right.
Why would we do things differently?
Well, no. They have seemed to be doing things differently, like with Cadence of Hyrule, for one example.
Here's the thing.
It's still different, though, John.
A lot of indie developers saw the Switch and said, guess what? We can get our games on there and not be crowded out by other people on Steam.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, so, I never would have expected this of Nintendo, so it was a surprise to me that this was allowed to happen, and it was refreshing to me to see it happen.
That in of itself is a bit surprising, because, like, the Nintendo Switch, a Nintendo system of all things, is an indie paradise. Who saw that coming?
Now, until it becomes... Because, like I said, the reason why it's an indie paradise is because Valve is so cluttered with garbage on it. And has to, and these games, these legit games, have to fight for visual space from all these asset flips. I go to Steam and I just do the what's coming out thing, you know, the list. And almost all of it is absolute asset flip shit. You know? And it's like, how could anybody sell their game when you have to go through all this garbage, you know, and they can't do it with Apple, you know. And that's why the Ouya was so big at the time, is because all these Android-developed games could find space to be, you know, oh, we're going to have our own system, you know, for real games. You know, that Tower game blossomed there, you know. And it became a genre all into itself. It was the one that led to Duck Game. So right now the Switch is sort of like, you know, it isn't crowded like the other things. We can have our indie games shine, you know. People get to find out about the Binding of Isaac on the Switch.
Right. And like people now that are developing new indie games, it's worthwhile to pursue the Switch crowd.
Because there's no one else there, you know. It'll be interesting to see what happens if the marketplace gets all glommed up, although ironically, I don't think that'll happen because the Nintendo doesn't know how to do an online store. At least Microsoft curates a bit. I mean, if I go to games that are coming out on Microsoft, you know, at least like you can tell the good games from, and there's no asset flip shit. Now, on PSN, is there asset flip shit? I know there was a couple of games that are ports from mobile games, and those got savaged, you know. But
PS4 is pretty curated. Like, I feel like there's a lot of stuff elsewhere that I can't find on PS4.
Yeah, but the thing is, there's some really bad mobile games on PSN because Sony wants to say, we got these exclusives. Yeah, but the exclusives are shit. So what? They're exclusives!
Right, but it's, I mean, there is a decent amount of games on there. I just feel like there's a lot of stuff I can't find on PS4 that I can find.
I'm just saying, you know, compared to everybody else, Nintendo's store is like the Wild West. You know, there's no one there. They can take advantage right now while they have the attention. And I think they'll retain that attention. Like I said, you know, people, the Nintendo store isn't cluttered. Not yet. I mean, I was about to say the Wii store shelves were cluttered with crap. You know, it was the physical version of Valve of the Steam store.
There is an approval process for Nintendo Switch, and I can't remember what went into it, but like I was talking to some indie developers about like the process that goes into getting your game onto Switch. And
the first one was, are you a real developer?
I mean, I don't know. I can't speak entirely to it, but I know that there is a process to be there.
Anyways, getting back to the main thing, I don't see how anything's going to be appreciably better than just having a gamepad with directional controls and buttons. You know, it's about as basic and simple as it gets.
Right.
Yeah, they're trying to reinvent something that doesn't need to be reinvented, I feel.
I mean, like I said, in the end, it's just you with a joystick. Anyways, look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with the industry news and our gaming history articles. If you enjoy our feedback, leave us comments on our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave some iTunes comments. You can find me on Twitter at Jonah Falcon.
You can find me at Johnny Chugs.
You can find me at Alpha Shard.
And we will see you next week.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Have fun, be cool, play games, y'all.
Oh, and by the way, if you're wondering why we didn't have a podcast last week, we did, but the sound was so bad that I decided to just chuck it rather than re-record the episode. So that's why there was no podcast last week.
Fair enough.
And bye-bye.